Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Jonathan Curiel and I'll be your moderator for today's program called Voices from Syria. We also welcome our listening and internet audiences and invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Wendy Perlman. Wendy is a professor at Northwestern University. She speaks Arabic and has spent more than 20 years studying and living in the Arab world. Educated at Harvard, Georgetown, and Brown, Wendy was a Fulbright Scholar and a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard's JFK School of Government's Belfer Center. Wendy is the author of We Crossed the Bridge and It Trembled, Voices from Syria. Would you please welcome Wendy Perlman?
Thank you so much for having me today. And as was just mentioned, I began studying the Middle East during a college semester abroad in North Africa in 1995 and continued with it ever after that. Studying Arabic, getting a PhD in political science with a focus on the Middle East. So 15 years after that, when the Arab Spring began, or the uprisings in the Arab world that became known as the Arab Spring, I was captivated as a regional specialist, but probably like most of you and most people on the planet at the time, by those shows of people's power. And I was especially attentive as word and attention turned to Syria, as protests spread from one country to another, Tunisia, Egypt, Yemen, Bahrain, many outside observers and Syrians themselves said Syria is a kingdom of silence. The regime is too strong. The military is so infused with the regime. The population has been silenced and intimidated by a history of state repression. Syrians won't rise up. Perhaps protests will spread everywhere else, but not Syria. So when Syrians also went out into the streets, I really wanted to know why. I wanted to know what pushed people. I wanted to know what it felt like, how it was transforming them as individuals, how it was transforming the country as a whole. And I thought that there was no better way to get answers to these questions than to ask Syrians themselves, to interview them and collect their stories. I first got my chance in 2012. By that time, it was already quite dangerous to go into Syria itself and do these interviews, frank conversations about politics and protest and so forth. So I decided to interview Syrians who had fled the country as refugees. I began in Jordan in the summer of 2012, basically interviewing every Syrian I could, and then continued for the next 4 or 5 years, and actually continue today, continuing to collect these Syrian stories. I moved on to Turkey, made another trip to Jordan, then to Lebanon, the United Arab Emirates. And as the large wave of refugees moved to Europe in 2015, I also moved on to Europe and did interviews in Denmark, Sweden, and Germany. I did some interviews with Syrian refugees resettled in the United States as well. Over the years, I spoke to over 300 Syrians of different walks of life. And my interviewees varied by age, socioeconomic class, educational background, home region, but the overwhelming majority identified as people who were opposed to the regime of Bashar al-Assad. In that sense, I can say that my sample, or the people with whom I spoke, in no way represent the full Syrian population and the full breadth of its socioeconomic and political spectrum. Political especially, doesn't fully represent the views of regime supporters or, also importantly, the views of Syrians who remain in the country and did not flee. At the same time, I think that this part of the population meets with too few opportunities to represent itself. And it's their voices then I was able to capture, for them to explain what this uprising and conflict means to them in their own words. My interviews were open-ended. They ranged from 30-minute conversations to group conversations in which many Syrians spoke amongst themselves and I was their audio recording, to intimate personal testimonials that lasted for hours or for days or sometimes for years, as I've been able to stay in touch with many of the people I met and sometimes caught up with them years later, often in another country after they had moved on as refugees. As I collected all of these different stories, I could see how the individual narratives coalesced into a collective narrative. And the book expresses that narrative. The introduction is in my voice, providing some basic context and history about the Syrian conflict. And the rest is exclusively in the words of Syrians themselves. It's a collection of testimonials, or a curation of excerpts of the interviews I did, arranged chronologically, beginning with what life was like under the regime of Hafez al-Assad, who seized power in 1970, moving to how the lives of Syrians changed when his son Bashar al-Assad came to power in the year 2000, then how protests began, first small and tentative, grew into a nationwide revolt, first calling for reform and then for regime change, and then how protest escalated and militarized into the full-fledged, brutal war that continues until this day, and finally, how people fled this war as refugees and began to make life anew in their new countries. In creating this book, my job was something of curating an exhibit or making a mosaic. For me, every interview was a kind of precious stone, and my job was to cut some piece of it that would sort of showcase its gem-like properties and then put them together in a sequence so that the sum was larger than the parts, so that it together told an account larger than any single story. So what I'd like to do for the remainder of my remarks now is share a selection of those stories and voices, moving in the chronology of the book to give you some sense of this arc and trajectory. So, from the first part, which is titled Authoritarianism, about life under the regime of Hafez al-Assad, here Ilyas, a dentist, said, "Syria had the appearance of being a stable country. But in my opinion, it wasn't real stability. It was a state of terror. Nobody trusted anyone else. Don't talk. The walls have ears. If anyone said anything out of the ordinary, others would suspect that he was a government informant, just trying to test people's reactions and gather a sense of what was going on. It's a regime based on command and obedience. Every state institution recreated the same kind of power. The president had absolute power in the country. The principal of a school had absolute power in the school. At the same time, the principal is terrified. Of whom? Of the janitors sweeping the floor, because they're all government informants." Next, from the section about life changing under Bashar al-Assad's rule. Ayhan, who would later go on to be a web developer, recalls this from his childhood, saying, "The brainwashing process starts when you go to school. We love the leader, we love the regime. Without them, the country will collapse. You grow up with that in the back of your head, constantly reminding you that we are living due to the grace of the Assad family. But even as an innocent child, you see that the whole system just reeked. It fed on corruption and grew. If you want to get a passport, you have to bribe this guy and that guy. From when you're little, you're taught that this is the only way to survive in this country. Everything is handled by how loyal you are to the regime. So you are raised on the principle that you have to show your loyalty." From the part titled Revolution, the words of Shireen, a mother. She said, "Oppression was residing in us. It was part of our life, like air, sun, water. We didn't even feel it. Like air is there, and you never ask, where is the air? But then, in 1 second, in one shout, in one voice, you blow it up. You defy it and stand in front of death. You have an inheritance. And after 30 years, you slam it on the ground and shatter it. Don't even imagine that it was easy to go out to a demonstration. No amount of courage allows you to just stand there and watch someone who has a gun and is about to kill you. But still, this incredible oppression made us go out. I encouraged my nieces and nephews to come with me to demonstrations. I felt that if they didn't try that experience, they'd be missing the real meaning of life. When you chant, you shudder, and your body rises, and everything you imagined just comes out. Tears come down, tears of joy, because I broke the barrier. I am not afraid. I am a free being. Sadness and happiness and fear and courage, they're all mixed together in that voice, and it comes out strong. Also on Revolution, Rima, a writer, who said, I was in a demonstration, and I started to whisper, freedom. And then I started to hear myself repeating, freedom, freedom, freedom. And I started shouting, freedom. And I thought, this is the first time I have ever heard my own voice. And I told myself that I would never let anyone steal my voice again. Next, on militarization, Captain, a Free Syrian Army fighter, who said, when demonstrations began, security forces came. We agreed that if they were going to shoot bullets, then we needed weapons, too. We were only chanting in the streets. We could have chanted for the rest of our lives without anyone even paying attention to us. But when the regime started attacking us, a lot of people who were on the sidelines started to join in protest, too. Because of the blood. Blood is what moves people. Blood is the force of the revolution. From the section on living war, Ebu Firas, another fighter, said, at first, one or two people were killed, then 20. Then it became normal. If we lost 50 people, we'd say, thank God, it's only 50. It's been so long since I heard that someone died of natural causes. Also on Living War, Kerim, a doctor, said, my son spent the first years of his life stuck inside because of the curfew and the bombing in Homs. He had no contact with anyone but his parents and grandparents. He was 2 years old when he saw another child for the first time. He went up to him and touched his eyes because he thought that he was a doll. In the section titled Flight, Talia, who would go on to be a TV correspondent, she said, the night before I left was the longest night of my life. I was alone with the kids and the planes were in the sky all night. The sounds of planes are scarier than the sound of barrel bombs because you hear them and wonder when the bombs will drop. The waiting is harder than the actual attack. I didn't know if we'd leave the next day or if this would be the night that we died. I had seen children torn in pieces before, but I wasn't strong enough to see my own kids in that state. I needed to get them to safety. The kids woke up and I got them dressed. I got two pieces of paper and wrote our names and phone numbers and put them in their pockets. That way, if someone got killed, people would know their identities. I waited for the driver outside. I kissed the walls on the street because I knew that I was never coming back to them. From the final section of the book titled Reflections, Adam, a media organizer, he said, one of the most profound things that I learned from this experience called the Syrian War is that the process of finding out what a country needs is never clean. Of course, when you're in a stable country with functioning institutions, it's easy to have a moral code. But these values are only possible because other people did dirty things to put that system in place. We opened a Pandora's box. We had this innocent childlike interest to see what was inside the box. We thought we'd get a present, but what we got was all the evil in this world. Now we need to close the box again, but it's going to take a while. What's crucial in this whole process is that you don't matter. And that's why you understand why people get radicalized. You're in dire need of a narrative to justify this futility. Otherwise, it's too painful. Now I'm working with an NGO that helps the free media inside Syria. I see my job as trying to support people who want to make their dreams come true. But I'm too old to dream now. In a month and a half, I'll be 29. I've got more to share, but I think I'll close there so we can move on to conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, Wendy Perlman, for your excellent presentation. We want to remind our listening and internet audiences that this is a Commonwealth Club program called Voices from Syria, and it is indeed question time. I'm going to introduce the first question. Your book is hundreds of pages. It took 4 or 5 years to do these interviews. Words have a tremendous power, and your book has a super tremendous power. Mm-hmm. I just want to say that. There's only one picture in the book. For people here in the audience, I can show you. It's the introduction of, I believe it's maybe in Jordan. Mm-hmm. This is a Jordan refugee camp. It's a young girl skipping rope. And so that's the only picture in the book other than a map.
Yeah.
But the rest are words. I guess the first question is, in this day and age where words in some ways matter less than pictures, than the visual, than slogans, where do you think the power comes from in your book? And did you specifically, decide, okay, words, only words, and nothing else?
Thank you. It's a really thoughtful question. So even that picture is the style of the publishing house. It's always their branding. That opening page of the title page has a picture. So I don't know if I would have even chosen a picture had it not been required for that. But it really was a deliberate choice to not have pictures otherwise. One is that I don't have photographs of my interviewees themselves. In doing these interviews, my absolute priority was that the person with whom I was speaking would feel safe and would feel comfortable. To introduce a video camera or a camera would utterly change that dynamic. There were people, and I never even got their real names. I don't know necessarily their religion or their background, unless it was something that they mentioned. I would meet people through another person of trust and say, could you tell me what this conflict has been like for you? Keeping it as open as possible so a person would take me on the journey and I would follow. Really talking about whatever they felt most comfortable speaking. So one issue was that it was never then intended to be a photograph where I would have the photograph of the speaker joining his or her words. That just wasn't an option given the security and other constraints and interests. But otherwise, the larger picture was I wanted people to sink into the words. And perhaps it was a bit of pushback at a time when there are so many photographs and we don't hear the words. There's also been some academic critique about studies of refugees that we often see refugees in particular portrayed as bodies, as masses of people moving, of people in destitution, that refugees are often portrayed as bodies, and we don't hear their words and their stories as human beings. So I was very much conscious of that, too, and wanting the words to come out. In some ways, photographs can be a distraction. You'd see, is a woman wearing a headscarf or not? Does the man look like me or not? Do they look wealthy or not? I just wanted people to be able to sink in to the experience and the humanity that's revealed in people's own way of expressing what they've lived.
And you certainly reveal that humanity, and you could easily be referencing the picture of the young Kurdish boy who died on a beach, whose image catapulted a lot of concern, a lot of international aid, and a lot of words.
Yes.
If I recall correctly, his father essentially said the photo, he had issues with the photo because he had issues with the international response. Is that sort of along the lines of what you're talking about?
Yeah. And then we can also remember the photograph of little boy during the siege of Aleppo in the back of the ambulance that, if we remember, Hillary Clinton mentioned in several of the presidential debates at the time. And I think throughout the years of this conflict, there have been photographs that sort of blip into the news cycle and get a lot of attention. And they can be quite evocative and quite powerful in eliciting international attention and eliciting empathy in ways that perhaps stories don't, and can shake up governments and can shake up public opinion. And in that way, I salute the photography. And another important thing to think about with all this photography is that a lot of it in the Syrian conflict has been taken by Syrians themselves. There's been an absolute blossoming of Syrians who picked up their cell phones and then later picked up the cameras or video cameras and risk their lives to try to document what's happening. So a lot of what we know of Syria from Syria is from Syrian photographers themselves, and their work should be really honored and treasured. But there's a question, especially when there are graphic pictures of violence, is that what the victim of that violence themselves, is that how they would want to be portrayed? Is it how their families would want them to be portrayed? It's an extremely sensitive issue, and there are times when I imagine it's easy to cross the line.
Some of the words, one of the best known sentences from the last 6 years was from Barack Obama, who talked about the line in the sand.
Yeah.
And that language created a lot of hope among Syrians. You interviewed a lot of Syrians who talked about being inspired to protest, seeing what happened in other countries, Egypt, Libya. And in Libya, there was, in effect, a no-fly zone, and the international community came to support those who rebelled. One question from the audience is, did you talk to those who had opinions on the role of the international community? And you did. You talked to a lot of people, and some of them were quite angry, and some of them were quite, well, that's just how it is. But there was a sense I got from reading these interviews of betrayal, and also, well, what else is new?
Absolutely. Nearly everyone I spoke to had opinions about the international community. So only a fraction of those made it into the book, but the fraction that did is very representative of things I heard and continue to hear absolutely repeatedly. And I think betrayal is an apt word, or abandonment. Many Syrians with whom I spoke had a sense, and these again are people who identified with protests, went out and protested themselves, sometimes were arrested and sacrificed a tremendous amount and lost a lot for this movement to try to create a more free and representative system. And they would say things like, you know, we thought with the West, all their talk about democracy and freedom and human rights, that if we went out and protested and our government came at us with tanks and bullets and systematic torture in prisons and so forth, that this world that talks about human rights would come and protect us or do something. And they very much feel abandoned, that that there was not action that carried along with the rhetoric of human rights and the civilian protection and responsibility to protect and never again to atrocities. And certainly President Obama's declaration that chemical weapons is a red line, and should the Assad regime use chemical weapons against his own people, that is something that the U.S. would not accept. Many, many people referenced that. And I was actually in the region in Jordan at the time of that chemical weapons attack. So spent a lot of time with Syrians watching the news on their TV screens and wondering, will the U.S. do something? Will it not? And many of the people, most of the people I spoke with, really, really wanted the U.S. to take action. And it's interesting because these are proud Syrian nationalists and patriots. They love their country. They have, many of them, a sense of worry about U.S. imperialism. They've been raised from media and curriculum their whole lives to suspect U.S. and imperialist interests. These are not people who like the idea of someone coming in to bomb their country. But at that point, we're at such a point of desperation, saw a regime that was willing to use any kind of weapons against its people, of a slaughter without end, wanted something to help end the tragedy and the horror that they were living, and were hopeful that this turning point would lead to that, and tremendously, tremendously disappointed when it did not. It turned out to be another line crossed, and horrors continued. There have continued to be chemical weapons. Even in the past weeks, there have been chemical weapons attacks have been documented. And besides chemical weapons, there are you know, myriad other ways in which people and civilians and innocents are being slaughtered daily in Syria. So the sense of total abandonment from the U.S., the United Nations, and so forth is strong. At the same time, there's a tremendous awareness that the supporters of the Assad regime, its international allies, have not abandoned, have been quite active. Iran, Russia, Hezbollah, other groups, militarily, economically, politically, have helped the regime be able to survive these years of war, and that appears to be where the war is heading.
As mentioned, there is an image in your book. It's a map of Syria that shows, of course, the borders with Iraq and Jordan and Lebanon, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people would be hard-pressed to actually articulate which part of Syria is which, and where the Syrian government has control, where the rebels have control, where ISIS has control, et cetera. One question from the audience is, why do Americans seem not to care about Syrian refugees? And I think the United States has taken in about 18,000 or so, and there's been about 10 million refugees, more than half the country. But I think that a bigger question we could ask is, why don't Americans seem to care about Syria?
Yeah.
I was wondering if you can talk about that.
It's something that bewilders and baffles me too. But I agree. It's not just Syrian refugees. It's Syria. So and you're quoting on that, resettlement is exactly right. Estimates are some 18,000 to 20,000 Syrian refugees have been resettled in the United States. Estimates are that some 11 million Syrians are displaced from their homes and have been made refugees. Some 6.5, 6.8 million of those, the majority of that number of those displaced, are internally displaced. So they remain inside Syria, but have had to flee their homes, might be living with relatives in IDP camps, in caves, wherever they can, or they're on the move, literally as we speak. Some 5.5 million refugees are living in the border countries, the largest number in Turkey or Jordan or Lebanon, smaller numbers in Iraq and Egypt. Some 1 million Syrians are seeking asylum in Europe, and all of that puts that 20,000 number of the United States in perspective. Why don't Americans care more about Syria? Maybe it seems too far away. I think we have the privilege of not caring. It's not affecting us so much. We don't have refugees coming into our borders. We have a long sea in a way that even Europe has more of a stake, having seeing more refugees arriving. I think a lot of Americans look at the Middle East and it just seems bewildering. We think these are Shia and Sunni and sectarian battles and aren't real countries anyway, and we don't understand. And it's easy to throw up your hands and say, oh, it seems like something tragic is happening to those poor people, but I don't really get it, and it's best not for us to get involved. Of course, that last question about getting involved is wrapped up in our own history the last 15 years. I think that President Obama, in his position of not wanting to get too involved, knew that there was a popular mandate for such a stance. After the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, the U.S. doesn't want more foreign adventures in the Middle East, worries that this could be a quagmire. If we were to become more involved, that it would be very difficult to dislodge. And how can we be reassured that greater involvement would actually make things better as opposed to making things worse? There's all sorts of question marks and uncertainty, which I think makes it easy for people to turn away. At the same time, as is often said, this is one of the worst humanitarian crises of our times. The amount of brutality is absolutely unfathomable. It's unspeakable. Chemical weapons, barrel bombs, millions of people displaced, families torn apart, children torn to pieces. I mean, it's beyond words the amount that innocent civilians are suffering day in and day out. So I think it's a tragedy that we don't care more. I wish we did.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
I want to remind our listening audiences that we're talking to Wendy Pearlman, who is the author of the book We Crossed a Bridge and It Trembled, Voices from Syria. The book, you know, you talk to dozens and dozens of people mm-hmm. from all walks of life. Mm-hmm. Many of them, as we said, feel betrayed about what happened, mm-hmm. And it's an ongoing feeling. Mm-hmm. But there are some people who have, you could even say, like a dark sense of humor about things, how it ended up. And there are, you've talked to some women, I'm remembering one from Turkey, mm-hmm. I believe, who was in a, maybe not an abusive situation, but an unhappy situation with her husband. And in a sense, the revolution and having to flee her homeland led her to liberate herself from her husband. And it's a real story of, it's a story of hope and a lot of other things. Mm-hmm. But can you talk about, in a way, the very, very complicated, you know, bittersweet stories like that, where you do talk to people, especially women, who mm-hmm. say, well, I'm making the best of this, and it's actually, in the grand scheme of things, I mean, not so bad.
Yeah, I think that there are these glimmers of hope and glimmers of change. I think what the Syrian uprising did was completely shake up society in every realm. It shook up political relations, the relationship between state and citizen, and that had reverberations for individuals who felt like they were reborn or transformed or changed by the process of protesting, or just because all of the old rules collapsed or were unsettled in many ways. So that has an effect on family relations, on gender roles, the relationship between parent and child, between men and women. Lots of people said it was this kind of opening. So there are glimmers of hope on that personal level, I think, in which people have somehow made the most of tragedy to perhaps dream of things they never would have dreamt of, or accomplish their dreams in ways that maybe were closed before. So, for example, there is that story of a woman who said, you know, before the uprising, I never would have thought. I was in a bad marriage. I wanted to get out, but I didn't think I could. But this showed me all types of things are possible, and I took my kids and I left. And she's now started a really grand new life. Something else that gives me the glimmer of hope amidst so much darkness is that there has been a tremendous renaissance of Syrian self-expression. You know, people before referred to Syria as this kingdom of silence, where there was tremendous censorship. People said, hush, the walls have ears, were often afraid to speak even in their own homes. In the last 7.5 years, there has been this flourishing in every medium: filmmaking, art, dance, hip-hop and heavy metal music, poetry, writing. Many Syrians who felt like they did not have a voice have found a voice and are expressing themselves in a way that is just an unleashing of tremendous creativity. At the same time, there is darkness that can't be ignored. There are hundreds of thousands of children, refugee children, who are working sometimes 12 hours a day in sweatshops or in fields and supporting their whole families in Turkey or Jordan or Lebanon or so forth. Think of what is the future of that generation of kids who are not going to school but working under the worst of conditions and for very little pay, and their whole families dependent upon it. So while some developments leave me to think that there's some exciting things for the Syrian people ahead, the overall picture, the macro picture, is tremendously bleak. And the photographs we see of whole areas turned to rubble and the daily reports of fatalities keep that very much alive.
Well, in fact, one question from an audience member references the New York Times, which yesterday had a front page, at least on the digital, and a front page headline about, well, actually the Syrian war is not getting better, it's actually worse, despite the, you know, oh, there it is, an audience member. Right. Despite the, you could say, the virtual ending of ISIS's control in Syria, almost, despite a lot of things, but that Russian bombing, you know, Assad is newly empowered, et cetera, is actually leading to more deaths. And I do want to say, though, as an aside, the New York Times, besides having that story a couple of days ago, had a really interesting story on a Syrian artist who lives in France. Mm-hmm. And it's really sort of what you're talking about, creating art from the tragedy of war. But the mm-hmm. audience member's question is, who is keeping this war going and why? And I know that's a fairly big question, but maybe you can address the edges of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's an ongoing struggle for power. You have a political system and a regime that wants to hold on to power, and now various different opposition groups that have not are continuing to fight fight that reality. So it's now a fight over land and territory. So this has the sort of hinted in the readings I presented, this began as nonviolent protests calling first for reform of the system, then calling for the regime to be overthrown. Regime responded to largely peaceful protests with violence. The opposition took up arms and this conflict militarized. And various state and non-state actors intervened in the cracks of this increasingly fragmented, chaotic situation. States and non-state actors that maybe had their own agendas and their own goals and their own patrons that were perhaps different than the original fight between state and society. And as rebel forces grew in these increasingly armed militarized rebellion, the state withdrew from whole pockets of the country that then fell under regime control. And as the rebellion fragmented from what was the first sort of more civic, secular goals of a freer, more accountable system. And Al-Qaeda came in from Iraq and then had various branch groups and ISIS coming from that pathway as well. You had struggles among different rebel groups for control of that territory. What we're seeing now is the regime, and it's supported by its allies, Russia in the air and Iran as a fundamental military and economic force sustaining the whole fight as well, slowly regaining territory or fighting to regain the territory that it lost. It has done so steadily over the past 2 years. So the major fight with the fall of rebel-held Aleppo that gathered so much attention a while back was a major loss for the rebels vis-a-vis the regime. And what you see now is this fighting in Idlib province in the north, which is a last sort of rebel-held stronghold, and in eastern Ghouta in the suburbs of Damascus, another sort of rebel-held stronghold, is escalating fighting in some way of the regime trying to take back the last of what it had lost to regain control of the territory. Of course, another element in all of this is the growth and militarization of Kurdish groups that are also staking out their sovereignty or hopes for sovereignty or autonomy in parts of Syria, which has then elicited the backlash of Turkey that doesn't want to see any sort of Kurdish autonomy on its borders. So there's a Turkish-Kurdish war in the midst of this, a regime rebel war, and then there's this ongoing fight against ISIS, of course, as well. So it seems that ISIS has been gradually is slowly being defeated, has lost the bulk of what self-proclaimed as a caliphate. But now the worry is that ISIS will take new forms. ISIS 2.0, the military folks are saying, a worry that ISIS now, instead of being a state-like structure, will turn to guerrilla tactics and roadside bombings and so forth. So the U.S. also now has a presence in the country with its military soldiers and advisors to try to prevent the re-rise of ISIS. So the whole ISIS battle is a third war within the wars. The complexity might come from the fact it's more than one war that's being fought. It's more than two sides that are fighting. And all of this is happening in this kind of kaleidoscope of shifting, such that shifts on one war affect shifts on the other, and the parties are continually shifting. And of course, civilians typically pay the largest price.
Yeah, you're talking about the division of Syria. And of course, one of the divisions is a Kurdish division. And you mentioned Turkey's fighting with Syria. One question from the audience is, how will Turkey's attack on Kurdish fighters in northern Syria affect the terrible situation in Syria? I know the Kurds have control of northern Syria. Northern parts of Syria. Mm-hmm. The U.S. is supporting, Kurdish control in a mm-hmm. sense. So it could lead to Turkish U.S. Not maybe not war, but something. And that is a very dangerous situation, of course. If the U.S., as you're saying, could pretend U.S. involvement or not.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you, I mean, I think you talked to a lot of Kurds, of course.
Yeah, yeah, and in different eras. So the Kurdish forces, different Kurdish forces have control in different sort of cantons in northern Syria, not a full contiguous block. And Turkey has launched an assault on one of those blocks to sort of defeat that Kurdish power. It's an extremely fragmented situation, but Turkey's watching the U.S. I don't think Turkey wants to provoke war with the U.S., so my reading is that Turkey will sort of go as far as it can, but is weighing various concerns, and I don't think the U.S. wants war with Turkey either. But in some ways, we say we're on the same side of a war against ISIS, but we're on different sides in terms of relationships with Kurdish forces. It's all a constantly shifting kaleidoscope, and Turkey's relationship with Russia has evolved over the years vis-a-vis Turkey's relationship with the U.S. It's all tremendously complicated and changes from day to day.
We want to remind our listening audiences that we're talking to Wendy Perlman. She's a professor at Northwestern University, a fluent Arabic speaker, and she's the author of We Crossed the Ridge and It Trembled, Voices from Syria. Anyone who's been to the Middle East, Syria, or otherwise, especially as an American, whether you're a reporter or an academic, confronts a lot of, you know, a lot of sentiment. Mm. I know when I reported from Syria right after 9/11, I met a lot of people, in a sense, who, just as we do to refugees, I suppose, said, "Oh, you're a representative of America, you know, and here's everything I feel about America and by extent you." Mm. Now, I happen to be Jewish. Yeah. You might be Jewish as well. I'm not sure. But you're a woman, mm-hmm. and you're going into Jordan, mm-hmm. Turkey, other places where there may not be as much, say, deference. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, you know, the one of the audience members essentially is asking about that. Mm. But I would add to that, what it was like to be in an environment where there are a lot of tears being shed. I'm guessing. Mm-hmm. Your tears don't come through in this book, but I imagine you cried a lot of tears and did a lot of trembling with people you interviewed.
Thank you. Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, it's an interesting question. Also, all things affecting, I guess, my positionality vis-a-vis the people with whom I was speaking in the project as a whole. One interesting thing I would say about being a woman is, in some ways, I feel like it's an asset in a way that people might think be surprised that it is. As a woman, you can, as a foreign woman, I felt like I was able to access spaces that perhaps no other space or no other kind of person, foreign man, local woman can access. On the one hand, as a woman, I'm able to access female only spaces. I'm able to be with women in the kitchen and be in women in their bedrooms and be with hanging out with other girls and women in a way that a foreign male researcher absolutely could not. At the same time, there's an awareness with people I was with that foreign women have different sorts of understandings of gender and gender relationships than maybe many local women do, especially more conservative, traditional Syrian women. So I could also access male spaces. I could go and hang out in a cafe with five or six men talking amongst themselves in a way that a local woman couldn't. So that, I think, was only an asset in a way that that might surprise people who haven't been women traveling in Arab society. So that, I think, only helped me sort of have greater access. As far as being an American, you know, that's interesting. I've often had a different experience that I've always found, and this is, you know, over 20 years of living and studying and being in different countries of the Arab world, that people are often very generous in making a distinction between the American government and American population, saying, you know, we have all sorts of complaints about your government, but you are different. There's a difference between the government and the people, so I'm not going to hold you responsible for XYZ policy, in a way that I feel sometimes gets American citizens off the hook more. No, you should maybe hold me and Americans more accountable. But in that way, I've certainly heard lots of criticisms of the U.S. government, and I participated in many of those criticisms of the U.S. government, but never felt threatened or in any way really criticized as an American. So maybe I was lucky in that. As far as, my own tears and my own trembling, I heard traumatic stories, and I was, you know, several steps removed. So I, you know, can't complain and don't have sympathy for myself in that situation. I was only a listener. But the kind of loss and pain that many people have experienced, they're really all Syrians to one degree or another. Last summer when I was in Germany speaking again to Syrian refugees there, someone said, you know, there's no such thing as a happy Syrian. That maybe people can laugh and joke. And I like that you sort of referenced humor, because there's a tremendous amount of satire that Syrians have also produced, which is fascinating and interesting to see. That people have moments of joy and so forth. But the country's being destroyed, and it's being destroyed before the eyes of the world and before Syrians themselves. And many Syrians feel a tremendous amount of nostalgia for a homeland that they fear no longer exists. That's just devastating. So whether people have directly experienced violence, whether they've witnessed violence, or they're simply a part of this disaster, the pain is sometimes defies words. And my job was to try to gather stories. So it absolutely affected me. When I began this project, there was still a lot of hope and a lot of optimism. The people I talked to who were refugees thought, we're going to return home any day now. Our bags are packed, and we're going to go back to a better place. And I saw that hope fade year by year, and the despair grow year by year. And now many of the people I meet are in a very different stage of life, where they're just thinking about starting life over. They're in Swedish class. They're trying to wrestle with the German bureaucracy. They're trying to get retrained. They're focused on their children who are learning new languages and going forth, and just trying to move on. So there might be a different way in which people kind of force themselves to look forward and find something to be hopeful about. But I coped in various ways. And I think what I tried to find over the years was a kind of a sweet spot, a middle ground in which I was still emotionally connected to these interviews enough to never lose sight that these are real human beings. It's not material to make a book. It's not data points for a project. These are real people. And I had to be sort of allow myself to be emotionally vulnerable enough to always feel that, but at the same time, sort of distant enough to be able to work, to be able to produce a book, to be able to read and write and analyze and have a craft. Because if I just gathered the stories and was personally devastated, I wouldn't be any good to myself or anybody else. I had a project that was, I was privileged, I mean, tremendously privileged to be able to travel. I've had these years of language training that allowed me to do interviews in Arabic and so forth, to have the resources and have the time to be able to gather these and hear tremendously inspiring stories, because also as much as they are dark, they are inspiring. People's resilience, the resourcefulness, even those who talked about being under siege and not having, you know, being starved because they couldn't access food, talked about how they would gather leaves and plants and boil them to make soup. I mean, in every way, as much as there is loss and tragedy, there is resilience, resourcefulness, intelligence, solidarity, all the things that get people through. So it was a privilege to hear those. So I was privileged and had, in that sense, a kind of duty, a kind of obligation to put those stories forward, and negotiated that space of emotional vulnerability and distance to be able to see the project through to fruition.
Well, I mean, it may be obvious to people who read the book, but your book is full of extraordinary people who some people would say are ordinary people.
Yeah.
But I have to say, like, so much of wars are filtered, especially through visual media, through the lenses of governments, government spokespeople, generals. Mm-hmm. This is a book full of people who are. Dentists and lawyers and housewives and house husbands, et cetera, et cetera, which I really appreciate. It reminds me a lot of Studs Terkel's book, Working, in some ways.
It's an honor, yeah.
But it also, I have to say, the level of bravery that each story evoked.
Absolutely.
And I just want to cite one example, and that is a young man, Hamza Al-Khatib, 13 years old, I believe, who was badly mutilated in Daraa. And his death and the rallying around his death, in a sense, helped fuel the revolution.
Absolutely.
And it was very brave in a sense, I believe it was his mother, to say, this is how I want him photographed. Like, and it reminded me a lot of Emmett Till and Emmett Till's mother, who said, this is how it was and this is how it will be. And that takes a lot of bravery, especially for someone whose offspring is mutilated that way. Can you talk about just those little things that often get lost in the bigger picture of war, but are really vivid in your book?
Oh, yeah, there's so much courage. And there was an expression that became ubiquitous throughout the Arab uprisings in Tunisia and Egypt, and something that Syrians say a lot is that this uprising began because people, quote, broke the barrier of fear, or the barrier of fear broke, in Kasr Hajas al-Khawf in Arabic. And in so many ways, big and small, people broke through a barrier of fear, that those who never even imagined protesting went out to protest, knowing that they were risking their lives, that maybe they would be beaten, maybe they'd be arrested, maybe they'd be shot, maybe they'd come back from the protest and the next day there'd be a knock on the door, that many people who demonstrated did so willing to risk their lives for a cause. So this breaking the barrier of fear comes through, I think, quite vividly in the question of protest, but in so many different ways. Because danger was really constant, especially, I mean, those beginning days, and now it's more arbitrary, you know, aerial bombardment and so forth. There's one story in the book about someone talking about a friend who was at a protest and was chanting and dancing and so forth, and linked arms on the right with someone and linked arms on the left, and were dancing because these protests were often quite festive, and then sort of linked arms, and then the people, person on the right and left, slowly walked him to a police car because they were undercover police officers. And people had all sorts of stories of that sort of, even at a demonstration, you didn't know who was with you and who was against you and who was taking pictures in order to document, and who was taking pictures because they were going to report to the secret police, and then later they would come report you based on that photograph. Also in the book, people talked about how there was so much fear and danger that even talking on the telephone, they didn't know if they were being listened in on. So people would talk about demonstrations using code and would say, oh, hi, has the bread arrived yet? Or when is the party? Or is it stormy? Meaning, you know, have the security forces arrived on the scene? That was the level of fear that people would break through. There's on so many levels, and continuing until today. So there's a tremendous amount of courage. And that's part of what really inspired me to do this book, because when I watched protests begin, I said to myself, would I have the courage to go out and protest? If I were them, could I do it? I don't think I could. So it was really in a kind of awe and a way to honor that heroism that I began. And then, of course, the Syrian war evolved into many different phases, and I captured other stories. There's also a tremendous amount of courage in the stories that emerge in the book from those who were arrested, who talked about being in prison and what it took to just get through that experience is absolutely harrowing. So there's a lot of courage that I hope when people read it are inspired by, and try to put themselves in the shoes of these folks and say, what would I do in that situation? Because I think it's a fundamental way of creating empathy.
We have time for maybe one or two other questions. One question from the audience is says that you could very well be talking about every other Arab country, especially Egypt, in the conditions you're talking about. You could also be talking about Iran. Mm-hmm. You're talking about people's times in prisons.
Yeah.
And one thing that happens throughout the book is that people have to pay. If they're lucky enough to have the money to pay, then they can get people out of prison. If they're not lucky enough to have money, then, you know, unfortunately, they languish in prison, and who knows what could happen. But can you just talk? And then one question is about, well, is there a future for the it's a future for Syria. Can you talk about, in a sense, it's a big question, but I hope you can address it anyway, the idea that, in a sense, your book about Syria could very well apply throughout the Arab world, and what is the hope, not only for Syria, but across the Arab world? I know that's a big question, but I'll ask it anyway.
Yeah, thanks. Oh, no, thanks. There are definitely themes that are similar, and experiences that are similar. I mean, I think in many ways Syria is just a really extreme case, that there is clearly violence throughout the Arab world. There's the protests that began and became uprisings have now spawned brutal wars. Yemen is in an absolute catastrophic humanitarian crisis and a brutal war from blockade and bombardment. Libya is, you know, broken apart in this complicated civil war with many different factors. Egypt has returned to an authoritarian regime that appears to be even more brutal and absolute than its predecessor, the Mubarak that was forced to step down, and so on and so forth. It's in many ways the Arab world that inspired us with this Arab Spring in 2010, 2011, is a darker, more violent, more sectarianized, more torn apart place than it was before, which just adds sort of more levels of tragedy when we remember the kind of inspiring shows of people's power with which the shakeup began. But Syria is extreme. It's extreme in terms of the technology of violence that's being employed, these chemical weapons, the barrel bombs, the sheer length of the how many years of war, the complexity of the international involvement, leading to these multiple wars being fought on this battleground of the territory of Syria. So I think in some ways there's glimpses of the same hardship, the same disappointment, the same sort of backsliding in other countries of the Arab world. But I think that the Syrian case is intensified all of this. And of course, in the sheer level of displacement, that this has now become a global refugee outflow and refugees wondering if they'll go home, when they'll go home. You have potentially the creation of this new Syrian diaspora in generations. We might talk about Syrian Swedes and Syrian Germans and Syrian Turks and so forth. That also, the refugee element is something that makes it unique in the among the cases of the Arab world. But the fundamental problem of authoritarian regimes that existed for decades and shows of popular uprisings to want to dislodge them or change them or reform them, leading to outcomes that are even more violent or more authoritarian, that is unfortunately the story a lot of the Arab world today.
I think we maybe one more question. So I just want to point out to audience members who haven't read the book that your book is divided into eight chapters, beginning with authoritarianism and ending with reflections. Mm. And I think a lot of people will do, perhaps as I did, is starting off with the book, but then flipping around. And even as you flip around, even within chapters, there's a great way. It's a great way to introduce yourself to the Syrian Syrians you speak with. There is a sense, I have to say, of what if. Mm. And what could have been. And one of them, I talked about the bravery, but one of the really emotionally powerful things that comes through is a lot of people saying, what if? And what? It's not just what if the United States had come in and, you know, done a no-fly zone. It's what if Bashar al-Assad had taken the moment to say, I'm with you, and this is a chance actually to be with you. And people were saying, well, I dislike his father, I dislike this regime, but we would have supported him completely. That's one of the bigger what ifs. And it's really heartbreaking to see that in your book. But it's also, with the distance of time, it's easy to see that in your book, which I think is really interesting. Can you perhaps talk about that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I have absolutely the same sense. So when Bashar al-Assad came to power in the year 2000 after the death of his father, he presented himself as a modernizer and a reformer. And most of the people I spoke with remembered feeling a lot of hope, genuine hope and optimism that this young, educated head of state, someone from a new generation, would make change. And it will sort of take you through the first 10 years of his rule, in which there was a first opening known as the Damascus Spring in 2001, in which there was a beginning of people to talk and have salons and whether they discussed politics, and some very well-known petitions in which intellectuals signed asking for greater reform and so forth. And that was shut down pretty quickly. And that showed many people that this hope of change was not going to be a reality. But even as late as, you know, March, April 2011, after protests began in Syria, even after dozens of unarmed protesters were killed by police and security forces, many still had a lot of hope in Bashar al-Assad. He was still personally popular. So I'll say one story that didn't make it into the book as a sort of extra bonus for everyone, that I did an interview with a soldier, because there's universal conscription. So he was drafted into the army, although he said his heart was really with the protesters. And he was sent to those early protests in Dara, and there was a door that was dented by bullet fire. Because the army was firing at protests, and this door showed all of these dents of evidence that the regime had been firing, had been shooting. And this commanding officer said, go get rid of that door. So he took the door, and he stashed it in a storage space. And as I was doing this interview with him, I said, why did you hold on? Why did you save the door? And he said, at that time, I was sure that our president in Damascus had no idea that the army was shooting here in Dara. And I wanted to save that door to show Bashar. And I thought that if Bashar saw what was happening, he would stand with us. There were many stories of that sort. The climax then for many people, and this is one I think a critical turning point in the Syrian drama and in the book, was when Bashar al-Assad made his first public address in late March 2011. So again, this was after dozens of deaths, and people were waiting for the president to address the public. He spoke to the parliament. It was on television. Many people remembered waiting for this event. People remembered where they were when they watched it, wondering, what will he say? Will he bring us back from the brink? Are we headed to war, or is there a way to reconcile? And at that time, people were still calling for reform. Were there certain reforms opening up newspapers, maybe allowing for more political parties, revoking the emergency law, which had been in power in Syria since 1963, that allowed security forces to arrest people without trial or so forth. They were waiting to see what kind of package of reforms might he present. At the very least, would the president show a kind of remorse and sympathy for those people who lost their life, show some recognition of a bare kind of legitimacy of the demands of the protesters and remorse for the loss of life. And Bashar al-Assad made this address and basically said, you know, these people protesting on the streets are terrorists, and if you want war, we're ready for war, and kind of callously laughed and exited the scene. And many, many Syrians said that was the moment where they felt like not just the regime as a whole, as a system, but the president specifically, was on one side and the people were on the other. And there was no space for reform. There was no space of reconciliation and compromise. This was going to be a struggle. So people had different turning points. For some, Hamza al-Khatib was a turning point. But many people talked about this. And reading it in retrospect, you think, gosh, this war didn't have to happen. Maybe there was some way that the president could have made some offering to the people. And many people said, had he done, offered some change, shown some remorse, we would have cheered him and made him king. But the regime took a different path, a sense of you don't make compromises with the street, repress, and people will get scared and go home. And that reaction, I think, very much provoked greater protest, eventually militarized protest, and the country's been destroyed. It didn't have to happen this way. That's part of the tragedy.
We want to thank Wendy Perlman, author of We Crossed a Bridge and It Trembled, Voices from Syria. We also want to thank our audiences here and those listening to the recording and on the internet. I'm Jonathan Curiel. You've been listening to a Commonwealth Club program called Voices from Syria. Now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 113 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.